Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyar, America's right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Well, we're going to cover the news briefly from Afghanistan and from the Pentagon today, and then get on to a story we began last night. John and Patsy Ramsey were on the Today Show this morning. They are being sued by a Boulder, Colorado journalist because they named him as a murder suspect in the death of their daughter, JonBenet, 5 years ago. What a tragic Christmas time story up the street from us here. We're outside of Denver, Colorado, and Boulder's just northwest of Denver in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. So we'll get to that in a moment. But first, the news, the big news today, the Bin Laden videotape, the home video that has Bin Laden admitting that he calculated the casualties in advance. Now, much of the Islamic world has bought the lies spread by Islamic Arab radio and television that it was not Islamic terrorists who crashed into the World Trade Center. In fact, many of them say it was the Mossad, the Jews, and their secret police. Of course, that's inane. But anyway, Osama now, and this played on Al Jazeera television today, as it played in America. Of course, it was in the middle of the night over there. And Mohammed Atta's father from Egypt, Mohammed Atta, the lead terrorist pilot who crashed the first plane into the first World Trade Center tower, his father is already saying the video is a forgery. And it's not Osama bin Laden. At any rate, for those who are in the real world, Osama calculated casualties in advance. He was working to keep the operation a secret. He sent them to America. He accepts credit for the attack. This is all from a meeting he had with a sheikh, an unnamed sheikh. He used his civil engineering background to help formulate the attack and where the planes should target the towers. His optimism encouraged the other planners. So that's what we find out about Osama bin Laden's participation in the planning of this. And he knew 5 days before the terrorist attack, he knew the final day that Mohammed Atta had selected as the day of the attack. And you know what else we noticed in watching that video? How they're self-deluding, these people. For one, they tell, what was it, five times during this conversation that they told about their dreams and who had dream. Oh, so-and-so had a dream of a plane crashing into a building. Somebody else had a dream. And Osama said one of his men came to him and said, oh, I had a dream of a tall building, and the guy was going to start telling about the operation. And so Osama said, don't tell anyone that dream. They're going to get mad at you. He said, I was afraid it would no longer be secret. So they rely on dreams to convince them, supposed dreams, to convince themselves that Allah is on their side. You know, the sad thing is that Christians do that too. But to convince themselves that God is on their side, some Christians, they interpret their dreams. And after a quarter of a century of hearing stuff like this, you realize that a lot of their dreams aren't really dreams either. They're just remembering them how they want to conveniently to get some kind of divine support for some project or other. And finally, Osama made the comment that in Holland, at one of the centers, the Islamic centers, the number of people who accepted Islam during the days following the operation were more than the people who accepted Islam in the last 11 years. He's self-deluding. Just amazing. Okay, and we've announced in 6 months, we're out of the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And really, we've been out of that thing for a decade. We just haven't admitted it. Because America made a treaty with the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union collapsed, any treaties that were made with the Roman Empire are no longer valid because the Roman Empire doesn't exist. Same thing with the Soviet Union. It doesn't exist. So we're really out of it. But anyway, to be gracious, we told the Russians, because we don't want them to feel too bad, you know, to go from a superpower to a third world country in a decade is really depressing. So we don't want them to feel too bad. So we said, hey, guys, we're pulling out of the treaty as the treaty allows us to do. So we're giving you 6 months. So, and of course, liberals are still against a missile defense shield. And that's because conservatives sell it in the wrong way. Conservatives say that if, let's say, China or some terrorist organization purchases a launch of a nuclear warhead on an intercontinental ballistic missile, and it's aimed for San Francisco. Well, you know, conservatives might have to think twice about that. But liberals, they don't care at all. They don't care. They don't want to support a missile defense shield. They don't want to be able to shoot down incoming nukes. Because we say, do you realize how many people that one nuclear explosion would kill? We've been selling the defense shield in the wrong way. We have to say to liberals, we have to say to them, hey guys, do you realize that very few endangered species could survive a direct nuclear hit? We got to sell it as a way of protecting trees and animals. So we tell them, do you know how many endangered species there are in California and New York? Do you realize one nuclear explosion could wipe out scores of species, endangered species? All we have to do is position it that way, and liberals will practically use the entire EPA budget, transfer it to the Pentagon to build a nuclear defense shield. Not only that, you know what it would do for our clean air policy? One nuke blowing up over Chicago? Huh. So that's how you sell it to liberals, and they'll be right on board with no problem. Okay, now, when we get back after the upcoming break, I want to talk about John and Patsy Ramsey. I'll recap what we talked about last night. Actually, I'll repeat a lot of it. Because they were on the Today Show this morning, having committed the serious crime of naming someone that they know is not guilty as a murder suspect in their daughter's brutal death. So they're on the Today Show because they're being sued, and they had put out this book, Death of Innocence. And you'd think Death of Innocence, if there's going to be a photograph on the cover, whose picture would be on the cover of the Ramsey's book, Death of Innocence? You'd think it'd be their daughter's, right? But no, it's theirs, because they've been trying to get out of the guilt of her murder ever since.
Bob Enyard teaches the Bible like few others, and one of the best ways to introduce yourself to Bob Enyard's unique style of Bible teaching is with the video Mount Moriah. It's a 2-hour feature video that answers all kinds of questions about the resurrection. Is there evidence for the resurrection still in existence today? Well, this entertaining and professionally made video will show you evidence of Christ's resurrection that has remained for 2,000 years. It proves that 1,500 years after God carved the law in stone, he carved grace in stone at Mount Moriah. And you can answer those who ask, those who doubt the resurrection.
Most people choose their long-distance company right after they see one of their funny ads on TV. At Lifeline Communications, we think that you'll choose your long-distance company for an entirely different set of values. It's true that Lifeline's rates are now 12 to 27% lower than the competition, as low as 6.9 cents on weekdays and as low as 4.9 cents on Sunday. But we're the only major long-distance company which gives away 10% of its income to spread the gospel. And we're the only long-distance company recommended by thousands of major ministries all over America. Plus, if you switch right now, we'll give you 100 minutes of long distance free. So what do? If you're serious about saving money and promoting the kingdom of God, you can do both with Lifeline, long distance with a higher calling.
Give him a call, 1-800-684-2931. Bob's monthly Bible study. Join up, folks, every Sunday night. We record a Bible study here in Denver, and we're going through the entire Bible. You can sign up for $24.95 a month. We send out 4 tapes a month every month. We distribute tapes right now to over 100 families around the country. Please join up. $24.95 a month. We can send them out automatically. If you sign up by credit card, give us a call, 1-888-836-9278. That's 1-888-8-NYARD.
Okay, let's recap what we talked about last night in JonBenet Ramsey's murder. There's some evidence in the case that seems to point toward her parents, and other evidence seems to clear them. So if we can only figure out the whole truth, then we would be able to explain every piece of evidence, because some series of real events produced every bit of evidence on the crime scene. And so that's what we want to do today, and I think we know what the clue is that breaks the case. All right, I think the murderer or murderers inadvertently put the key piece of evidence into the ransom note. Now, it was Christmas night, 1996, in Boulder, Colorado, that JonBenet Ramsey was murdered. She was in the home, the mansion of her parents, John and Patsy, Patricia Ramsey. Now, she died from a severe blow to the head that fractured her skull, a severe fracture across the length of her head, and by strangulation with a cord that was tightened with a broken stick like a tourniquet, and it left a deep mark around her neck. Now, she was 6 years old, and according to the medical examiner, she had been vaginally assaulted prior to her death. Terrible, tragic happening for a community, and especially for a little girl to go through this. Okay, now here are a set of observations that we've gleaned from media reports over the last 5 years. Sometimes we've had to correct them because, you know, the media doesn't always get everything right, and now we're part of the media on the radio and some states. But we've tried to get reliable sources, and so here's what we know. Patsy Ramsey called 911 just before 6 o'clock in the morning on December 26th, told police her daughter was missing and that she had found a ransom note. At 5 minutes to 6 in the morning, two neighbors come over, Fleet and Priscilla White. They're called to the Ramsey home by the Ramseys, along with other friends. Now, I want to read to you excerpts from the ransom note. It says this: "Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction." And we've pointed out that if, let's say, you belong to Islamic Jihad, you're not going to describe yourself as a member of a small foreign faction. That's what we might call them, but they wouldn't call themselves that. So right off the bat, you know it's a fraud. You know it's a fraud ransom note. "We respect your business, but not the country that it serves." How's that one? How many members of foreign factions that are going to kidnap a millionaire's daughter for a ransom, how many are going to take the time to compliment his business? You see, Ramsey's thinking, wow, my business is worth $50 million, and this might make big news, and I don't want people to think that our business is no good. I don't want us to lose contracts or value of the company. So he puts in the mouth of the supposed kidnapper, "We respect your business." So whoever wrote the ransom note has a great stake in Ramsey's company, the company he owns, but not the country that it serves. And then at this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed. If you want her to see 1997, you will withdraw $118,000. "I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery." And here's the key that breaks the case: "The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested." That phrase right there, "I advise you to be rested," that's the clue that breaks the case. "If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money and hence an earlier pickup of your daughter. Now, this is all absurd and fictitious. They're not monitoring him. If he drives, if he's got to leave somewhere to go to a bank or go to a vault or go to wherever he's going to go to get the money, they're not going to be monitoring him doing that. There's a reason why John and Patsy wrote this, "I advise you to be rested." They were asleep. You don't tell people who are sleeping, you don't advise them to be rested. They're asleep. And they're sleeping through a sexual assault and the murder of their six-year-old daughter. And the kidnapper's going to worry that they're going to wake up. And then if we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early. The reason these sentences were put in here by the Ramseys is because they knew that all the evidence points to them. They just brought their daughter home from a Christmas party. They're the only ones in the house and she's dead. And so they need exculpatory evidence. For the public school teachers tuning in right now, they need evidence that would make them look innocent, that would make them look not guilty. They need evidence that would seemingly point to someone else. So John Ramsey, he had to leave the home that night. They figured this out. He'd have to leave the home and dispose of some evidence and bring back into the house some other evidence to seemingly point to someone else, a different perpetrator. And so he needs to give himself an excuse to leave the house early and then to come back and to go to bed and to wake up in the morning and call the police just in case he's seen. What if a neighbor sees him leaving the house at 2 a.m.? And then he wakes up, they wake up at 5 in the morning, they call the police and they say, "Our daughter's missing." And then a day later, they find out, "Well, John, you weren't home at 2 to 3 a.m. You had left your house." You know, then everything falls apart. So he needs to cover his tracks in advance. So he says, so they say, "We'll monitor you trying to get the money early." So if he drives out at 1 or 2 in the morning, that's because, well, he's desperately trying to find her or maybe find the money. And then he can't do either. So he goes back home at 3 o'clock. And then what does he do? Well, he goes to bed. Well, why would he go to bed? His daughter's missing. Well, the kidnapper said, "I advise you to be rested." So he did his best to get a good night's sleep. That's what's going on in this ransom note. Let's continue with the excerpts. "Any deviation from my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You can try to deceive us, but be warned, we are familiar with law enforcement and countermeasures." Okay, now John Ramsey was dictating this letter to Patsy, and she was writing. And at that point, he left to go do what he had to do. We'll talk about that. And then she rewrote it. You know, the police found a draft note, a partial draft note, the pad the ransom note was written on. And so she added to the bottom of the list, bottom of the letter, she added this: "Don't try to grow a brain, John. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It's up to you now, John." And that was true in more ways than one to her. Victory, SBTC. The ransom note was signed SBTC. And I think Patsy was just, or John was just trying to come up with some initials. And subconsciously, they came up with that because the Navy had stationed him at the Subic Bay Training Center 30 years earlier. At any rate, the note's time element indicates it was composed sometime around midnight. At least the author was thinking that it was still the day before, and "I will call you by 10 a.m. tomorrow." So still thinking of tomorrow. In other words, it wasn't written at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. Just, that's a minor observation, but you might be able to glean that. And then this phrase, "I advise you to be rested." A kidnapper would not normally give such advice to his victims, and no one urges sleeping people to get rest. That's the clue that breaks the case. Now, the ransom note refers to JonBenet 14 times, but not once by her name. It states, if you want her to see 1997, avoiding the more heart-wrenching if you ever want to see JonBenet again, right? See, the parents are writing the letter, and it's painful enough, and so they don't use her name, whereas a true kidnapper would do everything he could to pull their heartstrings. Now, the letter is extremely long for a ransom note, and it demands a small amount of money. $118,000 was exactly equal to Ramsey's annual bonus. Now, that's peculiar. Detectives, they found a partial draft of the ransom note in the home in the legal pad on which the final ransom had been written, along with Ramsey handwriting samples in the home that were similar to the style on the note from Patsy. That's why the police repeatedly wanted more and more handwriting samples from her. And, you know, kidnappers are going to break into a millionaire's home and then sexually molest the victim, a six-year-old girl, and then kidnap her. Oh, and they're not going to bring the ransom note with them. They're going to write it there in the house. Right, exactly right. Now, a broken window in the basement had an obviously disturbed sill under it, the window sill. And the window was broken a bit. It was broken. And police found a scuff mark below the window and a piece of broken glass on the basement floor. But they found no footprints outside the window. And it had snowed that night, just hours before the murder. There were no signs of forced entry. The alarm system had not been activated. They had an alarm, but they didn't turn it on that night. It's convenient. Four people were known to be in the house that night: JonBenet, her 9-year-old brother Burke, and their parents. The police have no evidence pointing to Burke, and they've never considered him a suspect. Now, Detective Linda Arndt, you might remember her. She's the only police officer on the scene in the hours prior to the discovery of the body. It was 5 hours later. I'm sorry, it was 7 hours after they called 911 when John and a neighbor came up from the basement after a search of the house with JonBenet's body. So in those intervening hours, Linda Arndt was there, and she remembers Mr. Ramsey's demeanor when he greeted her at the door as not distraught and not even upset, but just cordial. And as I've said, of course, people experience grief differently and fear and worry, but not upset, not even upset, just cordial. Well, the detective says that the Ramseys did not spend those hours that morning in each other's company, but that Patsy stayed in the sunroom with friends. Now, if a married couple are not getting along and a child is hurt or missing or killed, even if they weren't getting along, that brings them together. Even divorced parents, when a child is injured or hurt, they come together. But Patsy Ramsey spends that morning with her friends in the sunroom, and John stayed in his den and he read his mail in the kitchen. Now, how's that? When asked that morning who might be responsible for the crime, John and Patsy immediately gave names. He gave an employee's name. She gave one of the housekeeper's names. That seems strange. We'll be right back.
All lines are busy at this time. For updated information on Bob's national tour and ShadowGov demonstrations, press 1. For Bob's mailing address, press 2. And if you're an atheist, an anarchist, an evolutionist, a humanist, a communist, a socialist, a garden variety, sodomite, a Democrat, or a transgendered freak of nature, press 3. If you're ordering by credit card, please leave your name and phone number, and your call will be returned.
Yeah, you must be them NYARC people. Well, I'm not like any of those things that I just heard in that list of things he just said. I'm not an evolutionist or nothing like that. But I was just want to know if you're the guy I seen on Politically Incorrect, yeah, that's it. I just wanted to tell you that I think you guys rock. You guys are really cool, and you need to keep up the good work. So this is George from Jersey. Out.
Hi, I'm a garden variety sodomite and a transgendered freak of nature, and I'd really love a call back from Bob Inyart. So if you could give me a buzz, my name's Cody Lightholt. My phone number is 7. I'd really appreciate being straightened out because I'm sick of being a dirty fag. So thanks a bunch, Bobby. Talk to you later.
Hey, Mr. Inyart. I have actually viewed your website, and then I saw you on Politically Incorrect 3 times. And, well, I don't know what to say about you. All I can say is that I had an uncle that died of AIDS. I'm sure you refer to it as the gay plague. All I can say is that the majority of gays in this country are better people than you. Better than you or any other thing that you could ever be. I hate you, and I wish you had cancer.
I have never in my life heard such a hypocrite as this Bob Inyart. How in the world do you dare put him on the air? How can he judge anybody? He is terrible. You ought to be ashamed to even have him walking around.
Hey, Bob, I'm drunk. And guess what? God ain't gonna help me on this one. Take a guess of what I'm drinking. I'm drinking some vodka and some strawberry crush, buddy. Let me tell you what. I bet you're against too, right? Yeah, let me tell you something. Oh, yeah, and juice, too. Guess what, Bob Inyart? I'll tell you something. Bob Inyart, guess what? I'm really seriously drunk, but anyhow. Check it out, though. So, I'm a garden variety sodomite. Bob Inyart. Check that box.
And we're back on Bob Inyart Live. We're talking about the Ramsey case because the Ramseys were on the Today Show this morning. And most people don't know the story. We are right down the street from Boulder, Colorado. We were involved publicly. Our church, Denver Bible Church, we weren't quite yet formed then, but it was the people that started our church, Denver Bible Church, fought publicly to bring pressure to get the Ramseys charged with the crime of murder. But, of course, we were unsuccessful. No one has ever been charged. And, sadly, the city and county of Boulder, they can go after smokers, but not murderers. Well, the detective, Linda Arndt, says that when 10 o'clock came and went, the time that the ransom note set as the deadline for when the kidnappers would call, she said that time passed unnoticed. She says that the Ramseys didn't remark whatsoever regarding the fact that the kidnapper had not called. Now, that strikes you as unusual, no? If your daughter is missing and the kidnapper said we're going to call at 10 o'clock, you'd think that all the parents would want to do between their tears is talk to the police, talk to the detectives, find out what are we going to do when he call, when they call, what should we say, what should we not say, should we record it, how are we going to record it, is the FBI going to be involved? They didn't say anything. They didn't say anything. 10 o'clock came and went, they didn't even notice. How can that be? Well, they wrote the ransom note. They knew no call was coming at 10 o'clock. And they weren't sharp enough to act out their roles correctly. Now, Linda Arndt, the detective, says she was confused about why the Ramseys would not speak to her. Normally, your daughter's missing. She's been kidnapped. There's a ransom note. The police are the main, that's who you want to talk to. Later, they refused a formal interview, and they refused to take polygraph tests. The detective suggested that Mr. Ramsey search the home. It was a big home. And he and the neighbor, Fleet White, they came upon the girl's corpse in the basement, and Ramsey ripped the duct tape from the girl's mouth and picked up her body. And it was quite a strange route to the wine cellar where the body was found, and it would be very difficult to navigate by a stranger, especially at night, especially with a struggling six-year-old girl who was fighting to get away to wake up her brother or her parents, especially when the staircase light switch is not where you'd expect it to be on the wall, but above and behind your head as you're entering the stairs. So Linda Arndt saw Mr. Ramsey carrying the body from the basement, and she saw JonBenet's arms extended above her head and realized that rigor mortis had set in and that she had been dead for some time. Now, that kind of rigor mortis to that extent sets in after about 6 to 12 hours, and there was also the scent of decomposition. So the detective knew right away that this girl was killed probably, you know, at midnight the night before. At 1:30 in the afternoon, a detective overheard John Ramsey talking by phone to his pilot and arranging a trip to Atlanta that evening for himself, his wife, and his son. So Detective Larry Mason told him, "You can't leave." Now imagine that. Your daughter's dead, and a half hour later, you are arranging a flight out of state for your wife and your son and yourself. Huh. The coroner, Dr. John Meyer, found evidence of sexual assault from the previous night, a small abrasion and small amounts of blood in both JonBenet's underwear and vagina. Three medical experts consulting for the police say that the injuries were also consistent with prior sexual abuse. A black light helped reveal that her body had been wiped clean, but that a residue of blood was left on her thighs. Right, so her body is wiped clean. So the kidnapper, supposedly someone from the outside, breaks in or sneaks in, sexually assaults her, strangles her, cracks her skull, writes a ransom note, cleans her body, leaves the body there, and then leaves. Yeah, that's completely plausible. Only by a liberal who has committed intellectual suicide. The murderer draped one of JonBenet's blankets around her body. That blanket held a pubic hair that was not linked to any family member. And there was unidentifiable DNA material beneath JonBenet's fingerprints. That's the exculpatory evidence that Ramsey went out of the house to bring back and to plant on his daughter's body so it would point to someone else. There was an unidentifiable palm print of unknown age on the wine cellar door. But over a period of time, there were scores of people in that home, friends, family, workers. The underwear on JonBenet's body when she was dead, the underwear she was wearing, the panties were too large for her, and they contained a stain that DNA could not link to any house member. Now listen to this. When Patsy saw her daughter's body, she exclaimed that she had never before seen the underwear on her daughter's corpse. "Where did those underwear came from? I never saw those." Now that turns out to be a lie. But so we're expected to believe that an intruder came in with a pair of underwear? Of all the other bizarre things he had to do? Well, Detective Steve Thomas later found out that Patsy had recently purchased that pair of underwear at Bloomingdale's in New York for her 12-year-old niece as a Christmas present. But 6-year-old JonBenet begged to have the underwear for herself, so Patsy kept it for her. And she put it away in back of a drawer, figuring, well, when she gets old enough, she could have them. Prior to the murder, even friends of the family knew of the underwear story. If Patsy did recognize the distinctive underwear and was lying, then what she was really doing was trying to point the police to the evidence of the DNA evidence on the underwear, which she knew that John and she had planted. And that's what John did. He left the house and he took that large underwear that wouldn't fit their daughter, not her normal underwear, not thinking that people would remember that story or even knew it in their haste. And he smeared that underwear on some stain, perhaps in an all-night restroom at a gas station or at a bar or a strip joint or wherever he went to get his exculpatory evidence. He picks up a pubic hair out of the bathroom. And then Officer Barry Harkop interviewed next-door neighbors and reported that Scott Gibbons saw strange lights and movements coming from the kitchen area around midnight. And a neighbor, Melody Stanton, awoke her husband around midnight after hearing a scream. And he said that he heard the sound of metal clashing against cement. Now, the Ramseys say they heard none of this. Their neighbors heard it in next-door mansions. Police found a Ramsey family flashlight on the kitchen counter, which was not normally kept on that counter, but nearby. Now, December 27th, 1996, the next day, Patsy Ramsey is exhausted, and she's lying down. She reached up and touched the face of a friend, Pam Griffin, the woman who had made JonBenet's pageant costumes. And Griffin thought Patsy was delirious when she asked, "Could you fix this for me?" As though a sewing machine could bring back her daughter. And she then remembers Patsy saying, "We didn't mean for this to happen." And Griffin got the definite feeling that in her weakened condition, Patsy had revealed that she knew who the killer was, that it wasn't intended, it was an accident, but we didn't mean for this to happen. The Ramseys have generally resisted cooperating with the ongoing investigation. As, for example, on February 19th, 1997, when they refused to allow police to interview John's oldest son, John Andrew. A feud developed early on between the detectives and the district attorney, Boulder's very liberal Alex Hunter, a district attorney who's never met a criminal he didn't like. Accusations of conflict of interest suggest that the reason for Hunter's frequent conflict with detectives and his sheltering of the Ramseys. On January 16, 1998, the Ramseys refuse a police request for a second interview, but on June 25, 1998, they allow Hunter to question them, his office. When we come back, the last segment of the show, we'll wrap up the Ramsey murder.
Some people believe that Christians can speak in tongues. Some people believe that speaking in tongues has passed away. Are we saved by grace alone, or are there works involved? Some people believe that miracles are happening today. Others don't. How can all these disagreements come from the Bible if it's the inspired Word of God? Is there an answer to all these questions? In his book, The Plot, Bob Enyart, pastor of Denver Bible Church, shows you the one Bible verse that solves all the apparent contradictions. Think that one verse can't solve these complex problems? Get The Plot today, and if you're not convinced, we will refund your money. Order The Plot for $29.95. Does God want the government to execute criminals? The Old Testament supports the death penalty, but now we are to turn the other cheek, right? The New Testament material concerning the death penalty starts in Matthew and continues through all the Gospels, Acts and Romans. It goes all through to Revelation. God and the Death Penalty is the video we've produced to arm you with the New Testament support for executing criminals. If the death penalty is immoral, then what does that say of God the Father demanding that Jesus Christ die on the cross for the forgiveness of our sins? God and the Death Penalty, a two-hour video exploring the biblical support of the death penalty, is available for $24.95 by calling 1-888-8-ENYART.
Bob Enyart Live is back on the air. But to stay on the air and grow, we need to hear from you. We offer many products with Bob's insightful and unique biblical perspective. If you appreciate Bob's ministry, let us know by writing us at Bob Enyart Live, P.O. Box 583, Arvada, Colorado, 80001. Or go online to KGOV.com.
All right, now, regarding the ransom note and the JonBenet Ramsey murder case, March 5th, 1997, police and handwriting experts cleared John Ramsey and Burke, the brother, as writers. The investigators believe Patsy probably wrote the note, and on April 14th, they request from her a fifth handwriting sample. Now, remember the duct tape that was on JonBenet's mouth? Well, the duct tape roll was never found in the Ramsey mansion, just the tape that was on her mouth. And the remainder of the cord that was used to strangle her, that was never found. And there was also a footprint 1 foot from the body in dust on the basement floor that was never, the shoe was never found. It belonged to a high-tech brand boot. All right, that's part of what they did. They taped her mouth, they strangled her, they took the duct tape roll and the rest of the cord and boots that they had in the garage, and they put a footprint, a clear footprint, and then when John left, he disposed of some of the evidence and he collected other exculpatory evidence to plant on the blanket, the pubic hair, under her fingernails, and a stain on the underwear that Patsy had bought and put on their dead daughter, and exclaimed, "Where did that underwear come from? I never saw that before." Now, the stick used in the tourniquet, in the ligature strangulation, that came from one of Mrs. Ramsey's paintbrushes found among her art supplies in the basement. Oh, yeah, and there were four fibers on the duct tape that was on JonBenet's mouth, four fibers that came from the red and black jacket that Patsy wore the night before to the Christmas party. And guess what? When she greeted the officers at 6 a.m. in the morning, she was wearing the same party jacket she had just worn to the Christmas party the night before. I've probably asked 100 women, is it possible that a millionaire's wife would go to a Christmas party on Christmas night and then the next morning at 6 a.m. be wearing the same red and black jacket she wore the night before at 6 in the morning? And everyone said it's almost inconceivable that she would do that. She'd take a shower and dress the way she did for the party the night before. Prosecutors often fail to convict parents who murder a child because most people cannot even imagine committing such a crime. But remember, Susan Smith drowned her two young boys, and Andrea Yates drowned her five children. Countless parents have murdered their own kids. It happens. And countless fathers have molested their daughters. And when you mix the two, it's destruction. So as a six-year-old beauty queen, JonBenet was publicly sexualized by her parents. They taught her to dress provocatively and coached her to saunter like a seductress. If the Ramseys murdered their daughter, what would the possible motive be? Well, the parents blamed their daughter for their own sexual abuse of her. Jealousy of mother toward daughter. Sexual incident that gets further out of hand than planned, and an outburst of wrath after a sexual assault that unintentionally breaks the child's skull. Then the actual murder and the kidnap scheme came about to cover up the initial crimes. So the ransom note is inconceivable from the perspective of an intruder, like the compliment and respect paid to Ramsey's business. But the clue that breaks the case is the phrase, "I advise you to be rested." No theory of an intruder can explain that phrase, nor much of the above evidence against the Ramseys. However, that key phrase explains the evidence, both the damning evidence and the exculpatory. And it shouts that the parents murdered their daughter and then worked to throw the police off the trail. On that Christmas night, after Patsy put her son to bed, John began to sexually abuse his daughter yet again. And one form of destructive behavior led to another, and at midnight, in a burst of anger and emotion, Patsy struck her daughter in the head, cracking her skull. They realized the severity of the wound and that JonBenet was near death. They didn't want to be caught, so they started to conceal their crimes. First, they strangled her, which both gets rid of her and makes what would have looked like an accident appear to be deliberate. Then they planned to dispose of any damning evidence, but they realized that without evidence pointing to somebody else, they'd be the only suspects. So who could they finger? Who could they point to? If they were to survive, the resourceful Ramses would have to rework the crime scene to point to an intruder. So they decided to write a ransom note, which John began dictating to Patsy. And as they wrote the note, they made mental notes about what evidence they had to dispose of and what evidence they could gather and plant to divert attention. Their note had to take into account that it might take hours for them to rework the crime scene, and the neighbors may have already noticed the commotion and might watch the house or even call 911. John needed to leave the house to dispose of the roll of duct tape, the spool of cord, the boots. Neighbors may notice them stirring in the house, or they might see John driving away or returning way past midnight. And even though they risked being seen, they were not ready to dump their best alibi. They needed to tell the police that they were asleep all night and heard nothing. So their desperation to avert justice demanded that they try that alibi. So they planned to, quote, wake up at 6 o'clock and call police. However, a neighbor or even a police patrol might have seen John Ramsey up at 3 a.m., and their wording in the note guarded them against that risk. If that worst-case scenario occurred, then Patsy could admit, yes, it's true, we found the note last night, and we were too afraid to call the police because of the death threat. So John rushed out to find her, and I searched the house. Then when John came back, he didn't have her, and we reread the note and realized that we had better go to bed to get the rest we needed for the next day. So that's why we went to bed, and that's why we didn't call 911 until after we woke up. But we thought that it would be better not to mention that we had been up desperately looking for her last night, because that might look suspicious. You see, that was their reasoning. That's why that note came into existence. There's no other possible reason for that note to come into existence. That's the clue that breaks the case. With that pretext, they went to work. John found a pair of unused shoes and made a footprint next to the body. He then took those shoes, the oversized underpants, and other damning evidence with him as he left the house, maybe about 1:30 in the morning. He went out to find a public restroom at a nightclub, a gas station, a diner, or even a strip joint, preferably an adult bookstore with video stalls. Somewhere along his journey, he dropped the damning evidence off in the trash. And at the restroom, he used the panties that Patsy had recently purchased to pick up a pubic hair and then rubbed a stain onto the underpants. Meanwhile, Patsy decided to rewrite the ransom note, and she authored the final personal contradictory lines, "Don't try to grow a brain, John. Use that good southern common sense of yours. It's up to you now, John." And Patsy then saw the broken ends of the paintbrush that John had overlooked, and she hid them among her art supplies. Later, Mr. Ramsey returned to the house, planted the lone pubic hair on the blanket, put the stained underwear on the body, and broke the basement window and disturbed the sill, which he, by the way, later pointed out to his neighbor. The unidentifiable DNA material under the fingernails was likewise collected by John, or by a few days of normal child's play. That's possible, too. That material did not come from an intruder, which would have suggested that JonBenet fought and struggled getting the attention of her neighbors, but not of her parents. To help explain to the police how they could have slept through the attack, Patsy Ramsey had taped their daughter's mouth shut. Now, some might think that this plan is way too involved for the Ramseys to pull off. But remember, John had built a successful defense contracting business. And Patsy, she had long ago managed to become Miss West Virginia. You don't do those things if you're not capable. And, you know, if there's a small foreign faction and it hates our government, but it defends our defense contracting businesses. Yeah, right. Only John Ramsey would write that. Only John Ramsey, the murdering, child molesting, incestuous John Ramsey, who should be dead by now because he should have been convicted in a court of law. But Christians at Thomas Nelson Publishing allow him and his wife to write a book trying to get away with the murder of their daughter at Thomas Nelson, and the murdering parents write defensive, a death of innocence, and rather than their daughter's picture on the cover, they put their own ugly, pitiful mugs. There's a book author, and he's an FBI crime profiler named John Douglas. He wrote a book called Mindhunter. And guess what? That book, Mindhunter, investigators found that book in John Ramsey's bedroom. And in that book, it reads in part like the JonBenet case, in the use of duct tape and ligatures to strangle and similar phrases in the ransom note. After rechecking the crime scene, John and Patsy Ramsey went to bed to rehearse their story. Neither slept that night, neglecting their own advice. That's what happened. That's how JonBenet Ramsey was murdered. That's how the crime was covered up. Our bankrupt criminal justice system was not able to convict O.J. Simpson, but yet it takes parents, loving parents, and it criminalizes their behavior. Harrison Klebold, the Columbine murderers, break into a van. They're on probation for that. They make death threats, build pipe bombs, describe their pipe bombs and their murder threats on the internet. That stuff goes to the police, and the police do nothing. They do nothing, even though these guys are on probation. They're committing felonies on probation, and the police do nothing because they're busy going after parents who love their kids, who might spank them the way their great-great-grandparents taught their family to do. We have a broken criminal justice system. We have the guilty walking free and the innocent so often under attack, under siege. Hey, this is Bob Enyart reminding you that the Ramseys are murderers and to do right and risk the consequences.